Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, and healthcare professionals to do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. In this week's episode, we spoke with Matthew Coppa-Greco about two very rare cancer types called pheochromocytoma and perioganglioma, also known as pheopera. Approximately 1 in 3,000 individuals have pheopera. However, because the symptoms can be common, such as high blood pressure and anxiety, the tumors often go miss or undiagnosed. Even more, 30 to 40% of these cases are actually hereditary. Such is the case with Matthew, who has had 9 family members with the disease in addition to himself. Now, he works with Pheopera Alliance to help those affected by the rare disease and to help raise awareness so more research can be done.
Can you just tell us a little bit about your experience with Pheopera?
Yeah, how much time do you have? So, to be succinct, this disease has been in my family well before we ever knew what those two words meant. So my great uncle had tumors removed in, I think, 1965. And then again in the 80s, my grandfather had bouts with it. My aunts had stuff over the 80s and 90s. And it wasn't until my father had neck tumors in the late 90s that I, in my 20s, had said, you know, listen to my doc, you know, my father has these tumors. Kind of seems like it's a family trend. At the time, I was a musician, so classically trained opera singer, and also in school for music. So I had said that this is kind of part of my livelihood, and the doctor refused to do the test, said that there's no way that I could potentially have this. And so I eventually became a, you know, if you don't do it, I'll have somebody else do it. And he did it, and lo and behold, I had 2 neck tumors discovered at the time. So this was in 2001. So I had the one removed, and when they went to go do the other surgery, they discovered that in the MRI, there was actually a mass in the brain behind the ear. And so that became the priority. So we went after that tumor, and then we did the other side of my neck. And we thought they were done, and they had never scanned me from the neck down. They thought it was all head and neck for me. And when I was working out in, I think, 07, and I started seeing stars and having heart palpitations. And then upon further investigation, found out that I had tumors on my adrenal glands, which is the original site for most pheos, and then at my heart. So I had those done at the NIH in 1 year, actually, the same year. And since then, I've been tumor-free. So during my first surgery, despite our best efforts, they paralyzed my right vocal cord. So I have not been able to sing since. And not to give the entire history unless you want it. During those years, my father grew a mass behind his heart, in between his heart and his lung. And on the second surgery, difficult surgery, to try to remove the remaining piece that grew back, he passed from the surgery. So, yeah, he was 54, and so it's a little too young, I think, of course. but then that, so it's an interesting story. So he passed away on September 14th, 2009, and I was scheduled to be in Parsippany, New Jersey, for an international pheochromocytoma conference as a moderator, a patient moderator, and to lead a discussion from patients' perspectives. And I wasn't sure if I could really do that, and, you know, my wife and I had a serious conversation and decided that, you know, my father would want me to. And at the conference, somebody from the NIH came to 4 of us patients and said, you know, there's no patient organization for this disease, and she simply said, you need to do something about that. And so that night, I was up at like 2 o'clock in the morning filling out like reams of paper of ideas and thoughts. And that was the beginning of the FEO Paratroopers, which was the first patient organization in the world. You know, formalized patient organization, not a support group, but a nonprofit advocacy group that was helped by the Alliance to get started. And we kind of worked together through the years. And then in 2018, we decided that it was time for the two organizations to merge.
Okay, great. And so with your family history, and then on top of the fact that this is on the rarer side, how did you and your family learn more about the disease and, you know, become more educated?
Yeah, so I think it wasn't until the National Institute of Health, when I was referred to them, that we actually ever heard the words pheochromocytoma. We had been told for a long time that our neck tumors were ganglia gangliomas, and never even, I'm not even sure it was paraganglioma that was ever really mentioned. So once we started to put the pieces together, I think we started to do our own research, basically. So my father learned about catecholamines, which are basically the secretions that come from the tumors themselves, and that's one of the ways the biometrics test for us is through catecholamines, and that's how they tested me to find out if I had a FEO. So once we hit the NIH, it kind of became a self-education process, and certainly their resources were vast in terms of giving us a crash course of what's going on.
Absolutely. And so can you talk a little bit more about the Alliance and kind of what you do there and, you know, its mission and its goals?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the Alliance, when it was started, I think 2009 area, was formed, I think, as it's a D.C.-based group that was really interested in promoting awareness, but also really getting a jumpstart on research. So they started in a trajectory that was meant to raise lots of funds and to bring about some change when it comes to pheochromocytoma on a bigger level from the science side. So when the Troopers started, we were at a different angle. We said that the patients didn't have a voice and needed, you know, advocacy and support and education. So we kind of filled two components of what a 501c3 should be. When the Alliance realized that, you know, funding for cancer is really only super effective when you're in the millions, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And although we think we still do our part for research, they realized that the way they needed to be effective was to include more of a patient advocacy and education. So we then, being very close to each other, decided that to have the conversation, and we came up with, you know, our current mission, which is, and I'll read it to you, empowering patients with pheochromocytoma or paraganglioma, their families and medical professionals through advocacy, education, and a global community of support while helping to advance research that accelerates treatments and cures for pheochromocytoma and paraganglioma. So that's more of a, I think, all-inclusive nonprofit mission, which is the community, the advocacy, the education, and the research where we can is our mission. That's what we want to do. So we've always said for the organization that our only leverage really is our patients, because those who are doing research, they consider it rare. It's hard to tell somebody who has a disease that it's rare because it's not so rare to them. But we understand that the penetration of the disease is lower than most. However, the prevalence of it is quite a bit higher than we ever thought it was, and we can go into that if you want.
Sure.
But, you know, what we realize is that when they want research to get done and to have people help them develop this disease, that they need the patients. And you know, Dr. Potsak, who is really the kind of the world leader on pheochromocytoma, is very famous in saying, and has said for many years, he's a clinician and a researcher, which is really rare, so he does both. But he said, we won't find the cure for this disease. The patients will find the cure for this disease. And I think he's saying that without them, we're never going to find it, even though he's the one that's discovered 15, 16 of the 21 genes that are out there. Mm-hmm. A pretty impressive resume. What we have learned is, you know, we've always known for many, many years that this is the most misdiagnosed cancer, the number one misdiagnosed cancer. And the reason why is it's been named the Great Mimic, because all of the side effects, the flushing and the high blood pressure and anxiety, and this is for active tumors, those that are secreting these catecholamines, well, actually dopamine and epinephrine, the ingredients for adrenaline into the body, those that are secreting create this havoc of symptoms that typically look like other things. So, for example, when I was starting to have my heart palpitations, even though they already knew that I had paragangliomas in the neck, they didn't even scan me. They did stress tests, and my cardiovascular doctor said, well, I'm going to give you Toprol, which is a beta blocker. I don't see anything going on. You should have this beta blocker. So even with somebody who they knew had a potential for this disease, they weren't even testing for it. They were using drugs to try to, you know, quell the symptoms. So imagine somebody who doesn't even know they have the disease, and they go in and they say, I have high anxiety, I've got high blood pressure, and it's rare for doctors to say, well, why don't we test for this? And as an organization, we kind of go, well, why not? It's a simple blood test. If you've used medication to try to mitigate high blood pressure, palpitations, flushing, all these things, and they're not working, why not do the simple blood test to find out if it is an active pheochromocytoma?
And so I also see on your profile, so your motto, seven times down, eight times up. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I had been in martial arts for a long time when I was a kid, and then I got back to college and met a guy who was doing some martial arts, and I joined up with him for a little while. And, you know, he had this simple phrase of, you know, we're doing a lot of grappling work, and he said, you know, you gotta, every time you get down, you gotta get up. And he started telling me about this Japanese proverb, which is loosely translated in English to seven times down, eight times up. And so there's been a lot of downs for me in terms of health and medical and, you know, my father's situation and everything, but I think that the person who perseveres is the one that gets up that one last time. So we have to do. We have no choice because, you know, if we're down at the end and we don't get back up, there's no coming back from it.
And what are you hoping is the number one thing that individuals can take away from the Alliance and, you know, raising awareness around this rare disease?
Well, that it's not as rare as they think. You know, a long time back, there was this rule that only 10% of these were genetic. Well, we're probably up to 50, 60% of them are being labeled as genetic. So we already know in a short period of time, basically since the Genome Project happened in 99, that this is a disease that can, it has components that can be identified and help to solve a puzzle. I want them to take away that it's a simple blood test and that, you know, we don't want to, you know, throw up any red flags, but this idea of prevalence versus penetrance. So we had an international conference here last year, and one of the genetic counselors said they had new data that came in, and it kind of blew us away. So at one point in time, we were saying statistics of like 1 to 2 per 8 million that would get this disease. And he said that the prevalence of the disease is now 1 in 3,000. And what that means is that those who have potential gene genomic carriers for this disease, now they can never ever have a problem, never ever have a disease. Nobody in their family could potentially have the disease. They just have the genetic marker. It's 1 in 3,000. So that tells us that this is a far more widespread disease than people give credence to, even though we do know it's lower on the scale than other cancers. But we really believe that there's more out there, that there's more that needs education. And like you go to a conference and we tell them about FEO, and people are like blown away that we have a FEO organization, you know. So even within a small group of people, NETs, we're the small group within the small group. We want people to know that their support and you know, especially in the genetic side, you know, people find out that their family members have this. We have a family in Buffalo, I think it's 54 members of their family
Wow.
that have a gene. And this is what happens with this disease, is that, you know, it's a genetic sort of disease. It's far more prevalent than is known. We want it to have its the education, and we want the physicians to be open to this as an option, as a potential diagnosis, especially when everything else is not coming back conclusive.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. So on the way that I like to kind of bring everything together, what would you say is your biggest piece of advice for somebody who is facing a diagnosis of pheochromocytoma?
Well, the funny thing is that most of the patients don't even get that diagnosis. They go years and years and years without a diagnosis. There's so many things that went wrong, and there's so many things that are going on symptomatically, and they finally, you know, get to that point. I think once you have a diagnosis of pheochromocytoma, there actually are a lot of options for treatments, and there's a lot of options, and there's maybe not as many doctors that are well-trained. We understand that. There's not as many centers of excellence as we would like, but there's a lot we know about the disease, and I think that's empowering, you know? It's a very large, I won't say large, there is a very strong community of support. I work in cancer, so I'm a program and events coordinator for a cancer center, and, you know, I've seen a lot of cancer groups, and pheochromocytoma and para groups, like support groups and patients, are some of the most giving and supportive and rabidly avid advocators for this disease than I've ever seen. And mostly because they went through such a fight to get to where they are. And they want to educate people on what their steps were and what they did to try to make it better for somebody else coming down the line. I often wrap up interviews, you know, like this, radio interviews, stuff like that, with this idea that, you know, the question is, why should other people care? You know, why should you in your everyday life really care about this rare disease that'll likely never ever touch your life? And, you know, there's so many other cancers out there that are so much bigger and taking, you know, more lives than this one. And my response to that is that this small disease has so many components that we know about, the genetic components, some of the treatment options, the scanning, the diagnosis, the use of the catecholamines and metanephrine testing to find out if you have the pheo, that if you could solve one small piece of the cancer puzzle, it would have great effect on all the other pieces. If we were able to solve and cure this one small rare disease, I guarantee it has other effects on other cancers out there. They should be paying attention to what we're doing. They should be paying attention that we've identified this many genes in such a small cancer, rare cancer. That should really perk up the ears of those who are dealing with larger cancers with bigger problems. They should be interested in us. We're part of their process of solving their own problem.
For more information, visit pheochromocytoma.org. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcast. The Cure Talks Cancer Podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.